This podcast is generously supported by Themis Bar Review. For more information about Themis, check out themisbar.com. That is themisbar.com. Thank you very much. And now back to the show. All right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. So, by the way, I'm David Schleicher. Sam, what's up, man?
Not much. It's a new semester, and that means there's a new season for our storied podcast.
I was just in Austin, Texas, where there's signs of people saying all right all the time. So I was most people are put in mind of the classic movie Dazed and Confused. I was put in mind of me doing a bad impression of Matthew McConaughey. So on the beginning of these episodes. So there you go. So but yeah. So we're starting off a new semester. Who do we have with us?
We have our treasured colleague, Robert Post, who's come on to talk about his monumental mammoth contribution to the history of the Supreme Court called the Taft Court, Making Law for a Divided Nation, 1921 to 1930. Which is just out.
It's really exciting. It is both mammoth, but also mammothly important. And so it was Robert's the best. So this is a really wonderful conversation. So I hope you all enjoy it. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. We are so excited to welcome Robert Post, our brilliant and beloved colleague, former dean of the Yale Law School, Sterling Professor at Yale University, to the podcast to talk about his long, 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 long-awaited multi-volume project, The Taft Court, Making Law for a Divided Nation, 1921 to 1930, which is volume 10 of the Oliver Wendell Holmes Divisive History of the Supreme Court of the United States. So, Robert, the question on everyone's mind is, I'm sure everyone read the big review in The New Yorker, the real question is, how is this different from Mac Barnett's children's classic, President Taft is Stuck in a Bath? Is it the same, different? Okay.
Well, like that book, it's all wet.
Okay, so a bit more seriously, by the way, seriously read that book. That one's awesome. This is too, by the way. Why the Taft Court? You reveal in the beginning of the book that writing the history of the Taft Court, the Holmes device of the Taft Court, almost killed two of our most august colleagues, that both Alexander Bickel and Robert Cover were assigned this responsibility and didn't survive it, and died leaving it to you. Why is Taft and the Taft Court worth all of this? And relatedly, like, you've done a really different thing with this than the other Holmes devices, which are basically like play-by-play reports of Supreme Court cases. So why is the Taft Court so important? And why did you structure and think about the problem the way you did?
Well, the first thing is I got assigned the Taft Court. You know, when you get one of these volumes, they don't say, what would you like? They say, here is this volume. And when I got it, I thought I had drawn the short straw. I thought, oh my God. Because, like, I bet you can't name 10 cases from the Taft Court. No, nobody can, you know. So it's a court kind of stuck in oblivion.
I can now, for sure.
Now you can, yes. and maybe I can still remember 10 cases if I'm lucky. So and for the longest time, the question of, you know, how to frame this and, you know, how to make a coherent narrative, it never gelled. And what gelled it for me was Trump, actually. For two reasons. One is Harding is elected in 1920, anointed is probably the better word. His mission is to return to normalcy, that is to say, to return to the right, to undo all the reforms of the Progressive Era, as well as World War I, which radically changed the nature of the state, the American state. And the court was part of that strategy. So in 15 months, he appoints four justices, all aimed at pushing the court to the right. And they do their job so successfully, it leads to the crisis of the New Deal. So it was a matter of conservative overreaching, just like what you see potentially now in the court. That's one issue. And the other issue is that the 1920s, like now, was an intensely polarized time. It was so polarized over issues like prohibition. But remember, we have the KKK on one side and we have the Jazz Age on the other. It was so polarized that in 1920, for the one and only time in the history of the country, Congress does not reapportion based on a census because the dries thought it would give too much power to wet urban areas. That is intense polarization. And the challenge for a court in the middle of polarization is how you announce opinions that have the legitimacy of law and aren't instantly received as merely, to use the phrase that Stone uses in the 30s, the personal predilections of the particular justices. So this is a narrative rhetorical construction to create law. And part of the book is how that, you know, what the strategies were in the 20s. But this, the court presently faces the same set of issues. And so I could organize it around the same challenges that the court now has. And that's what allowed me to give an overarching narrative structure to the book.
Well, you know, all history is contemporary history in a sense. And, you know, this is also Robert Post's history, where the Supreme Court is theorized in a certain way, past and present. We want to get into all that. But first, let me say, this is an absolutely staggering, you know, achievement. I mean, I was skeptical that the Kent professor of law could possibly deserve 1,500 pages. But it is well worth all the time that anyone would want to put into it. And I haven't completed every page, but what I've read, it's just miraculous. So, I mean, there's so many ways in, and we're just going to pick a few. But why don't we start with 1923? And, you know, you made me teach con law, and now I can cite two cases from that year, even before your book, Adkins versus Children's Hospital and Meyer versus Nebraska. So why don't you tell us, you know, how you think about liberty as it is defined and redefined in those cases and by this court, you know, given the conservative retrenchment that President Harding intends.
Well, first, let's just say Adkins is a case in which the court, to the intense consternation of the country, strikes down the minimum wage law for women and for minors, but just for women. In the District of Columbia. And Myers is a case in which the court, over the dissent of Holmes and Sutherland, strikes down a Nebraska law prohibiting the teaching of German before a certain age. So those are the two cases you're talking about. So the larger historic context here is there's a big debate among legal historians. These are technical legal historians, not big think legal historians. And the question is should we understand substantive due process as protecting liberty? Or should we understand it as protecting against class legislation? And one thing that I became convinced of in reading these cases, and believe me, it takes a lot of time to read every case that the court has done, you know, for 10 terms, is that it's not a case of class legislation. They use the rhetoric of class legislation in some contexts, particularly labor, but it's vestigial and it's not doing any analytic work at all. We can talk about why that is. And the real problem of the era is posed by World War I. So you may remember World War I comes along and it's the first war that requires total mobilization of the economy. This had never happened before in the United States. And you realize that to win a 20th century war, you have to turn the whole economy into an engine of war production. They saw that Germany was doing it and they saw that England was doing it. So they thought the UK was doing it. So we have to do that or we lose the war. So remember, this is coming smack in the middle of debates over laissez-faire, smack in the middle of debates over the federal government versus the states. And it's the federal government which does that. And it does it in a way which exercised more control over the economy than ever before or ever since. So they take control of the shipping, they take control of the railroads, they take control of the telegraph industry when they refuse to allow unions. They set the price of virtually all consumer goods. They create a labor policy that says there should be a living wage. Taft creates a labor policy. There should be a living wage. They recognize unions. They do all sorts of things that are blatantly unconstitutional. They don't do it under the war power, but they do it. And the country is like, what? And Woodrow Wilson, who is the new freedom man, who was like, you know, I'm for decentralization, I'm for states, I'm for, it says, what? And so the minute, the second the war is over, he gets rid of all of these agencies, but not before it has caused a Republican landslide on the grounds that the executive has turned into a tyrant. And the theory of the tyrant is it's taken away our liberty, our economic liberty. So the court, the D.C. Circuit that decided Atkins, says the real issue, you know, we have life, liberty, and property, but very famously it says, and of these, the most important is property. Why? Because if you take away the liberty to participate in the market, the citizen becomes the mere automaton of the state, right? So they're imagining all of this as liberty. And so one of the issues is, what kind of liberty are they imagining? You know, what is the center of liberty there? So there are two strands of basically the court theory, the book theorizes that there are four different narratives one can see for grounding constitutional law. Two of them are in play in the majority opinion in Atkins. One is a very traditional sense of a custom and tradition. That was pure American jurisprudence in the 1890s. James Coolidge Carter, for example, exemplified this. It's really interesting, very strong Hegelian influences in American thinking on this, but it also comes out of common law thinking, that the custom and tradition and the habits of the American people is the grounding of all law. Law is the immanent order of society. And you say that because it gives power to judges who are experts in customs as opposed to legislatures who, as you know, any conservative jurisprude like Brewer would say, is merely a mob gathered on the street corner at the Capitol. That's what legislation is. And so judges say what people really want. And that's custom. So a minimum wage is inconsistent with custom. And so people like McReynolds are opposed to it for that reason. Sutherland and Taft, on the other hand, have this theory of constitutional rights that stresses property. The most important rights, like the court said below, are property rights. And why are property rights so important? And this is like neoliberalism of avant-la-lettre. I mean, this is really what it is. The property rights are so important, says Taft. It's very hard to get this out of Sutherland. You see it in bits and pieces. You see it in bits and pieces in Butler. But the virtue of Taft is that he has 600,000 letters in the Library of Congress. You can know what the man is thinking. Also, he publishes a book every other week. So you kind of get a sense of why he's doing what he's doing. And he felt like obligated to be explicit about it. He says that what Americans really want is prosperity. What Americans really want is for the economic pie to grow. Think of law and economics, and that wealth should be the measure of legal rules. It's the same thing. And so whatever they agree to in a bit of legislation, that's superficial. The deep consensus, the way in which you ground constitutional law with what Americans really want and will recognize it as deep, legitimate, guiding principles for the American polity, is that the economy is prior to the politics, and the economy is about incentives. And if you regulate property in ways that destroy those incentives, you destroy America. And the Constitution is therefore enshrining a certain vision of what the economy is like that is neoliberal in that way. And that's what's going on with Sutherland. The interesting thing about Atkins, of course, is that Taft dissents in it, because he says here the economy is not working because women are not being, you know, they're not having voluntary contracts. And so that's always, you know, a critique within this, whatever. So Atkins is about that from Sutherland's point of view, almost certainly.
So let me just interject, because, you know, you've told us a little bit about not just Atkins, but the way that this court, and especially the conservatives, are put there in a sense for nostalgic reasons, to remember the American way before World War I and the huge expansion of especially state authority and federal authority in particular. When you turn to Meyer, though, I mean, this seems in a sense different. because it is, you know, it's good law even today. It's the source of what we call substantive due process because it expands Lochner later, you know, silently overruled to give kind of constitutional liberties in the personal domain from which all these later cases, case law springs, some like Roe since extinguished. But it's hard, it seems harder to argue that that kind of thing was the American way before World War I. And as we've discussed, Meyer seems, you know, particularly coming in such close proximity to Adkins, in the face of the rage that, you know, class economic liberalism is inciting, also a kind of, you know, way of saying the Constitution's not just about economic liberty and, you know, custom in custom or just as a freestanding dogma about the importance of property to liberty. So, you know, talk about Meyer a bit and the way in which it's similar and different from in relation to Adkins.
So the first of the conservative views that I gave you went to custom and tradition. And custom and tradition and common law rights are very closely connected in the mind of the justices who believe that. And they all believe that, you know, it's a question of emphasis in any given case. So for example, Taft will say, custom is tradition tells us that prohibition is okay. It's okay to ban alcohol. It's not an unconstitutional violation of substantive due process. And that, and he gives a perfectly Hegelian common law understanding of why that would be so. So if you read very carefully Meyer, the 14th Amendment protects not merely economic liberties, but all the liberties and privileges that you would have had at common law. And he gives a long list, like the right to have, you know, to marry and to raise your kids and to educate your kids. It gives a whole set of understandings of what liberty looks like that are not merely economic. So that's an important thing to understand about liberty. There is a separate stream that is neoliberal, which talks about incentives, which is not liberty. That's managerial. That's like law and economics, which is not a libertarian science. This notion out of the common law is liberty, but it's Republican liberty, because he understands, McReynolds, who writes this opinion, understands liberty in the sense of how you have to be independent of the state in order to be an American citizen. And this is quite explicit in Pierce, which is the decision after, where he basically adopts the same line about not being the product of the state, but you have to be independent of the state. So they understand this as Republican liberty. Now, Meyer is a fascinating case for many, many reasons. For one thing, Holmes dissents. Holmes dissents for the class of progressive reason that you would much appreciate, Sam, which he says we have to defer to the state because this is a policy about do we need national unity? And it's perfectly plausible that if you have people who aren't speaking English but a foreign language, they can't be integrated into the society. So the policy is passes the reasonable person test, therefore I dissent. That's Holmes. And Holmes' narrative for constitutional law isn't just that. It rests in a deep kind of positivism. And what he says is that the sovereign, he has what the sovereign is. The sovereign is dominant opinion. And the spokesperson, his word is the mouthpiece of dominant opinion is the legislature, which is constructed to allow for orderly change. Holmes says in his very earliest opinion, this idea of the common law and speaking for a united set of customs and traditions is false from the get-go. America has no customs and traditions, which are universal. America is a site of conflict. He was looking at the conflict between unions and capital. He was looking at the conflict between religious and not religious. He was looking at all these forms of conflict, which was filling the society. And he says, only a crazy person would think we have something in common here. We don't have anything in common. And the law is a way, it's a system for preventing us from killing each other in a Hobbesian war of all against all. And therefore, our job is to defer to the legislature. So he defers to the legislature in Myers and dissents. Brandeis, however, joins McReynolds and he strikes down the law. Now, Brandeis and Holmes each thought you should defer to Democratic legislature for totally different reasons. The fourth narrative about constitutionality that I discerned in the 20s is that which is attaches to Brandeis alone. He's the only person who thinks this way, which was stunning to me to find, because I would have thought that it would have been a common way. And we all think that way now. And so you tend to read it back, but you don't see anyone else making these points judicially or any other way, actually. With the possible exception, I know you argue Thayer did, but I don't think he develops it the way Brandeis does. Brandeis's account is, look, the central narrative of America is democracy. And democracy is an ethical thing. It's not just a matter of majoritarianism. It's not just a matter of channeling conflict the way Holmes has no theory of human flourishing. Brandeis has a theory of human flourishing. Flourishing is being able to create your own destiny through a democracy. So it's like McReynolds, it's Republican in some way, but his notion of democracy is you have to give people the power to develop to be the democratic sovereigns. And the common law doesn't do that because the common law is out of sync with the forms of power which are oppressing people and disqualifying them from being democratic citizens. And so we have to enforce those rights which are necessary for democracy, even though we have to defer to any other enactment of the democracy out of deference to democracy. So for Brandeis, one, anytime you set aside legislation, there are two constitutional issues. One is democracy and respect for democracy. And the other is whatever constitutional right might be at stake. This is balancing constitution against constitution. Holmes didn't see it that way. Holmes just says we have to defer to the legislature. And Taft didn't see it that way. There was just property rights. Democracy wasn't a separate constitutional value, nor was it for McReynolds, only for Brandeis. So the first thing he sees is it's a matter of judgment whenever you set aside a democratic enactment, because you're balancing two democratic rights. And then he says he's got this conversation, these wonderful conversations with Frankfurter, which were recorded and published. And he's writing at the time of Myers, there are certain rights which are so necessary to democracy, like right to speech and right to travel and right to education, which is Myers, that one cannot defer because it's necessary for the very value of democracy itself. So that's his view. And so he and Holmes separate on this, and it shows it's a measure of the profound differences in their jurisprudence. And Myers is an extremely important case because it divides progressives into two camps. People like Frankfurter and Hand go with Holmes, and people like Walter Lippmann go with Brandeis.
So I think we're going to come right back to the Brandeis-Holmes thing in a little bit, but I wanted to put a pin or kind of go back a little bit to your discussion of Taft as proto-economist or proto-law and econ figure, because there's something that's a little bit funny about that story, which is there are a lot of cases that don't fit so neatly. And so I think most notably is Village of Euclid, which doesn't fit neatly at all. It's a case that has two features that don't fit neatly. One is it's about planning, and the court endorses it. And then secondly, it's a case in which the court does its clearest embrace of living constitutionalism. Of any case that the court has ever decided, the court basically says, like, people say, who's a living constitutionalist? Well, the answer is like the Euclid court. And so also you see something kind of a little bit dissonant in the antitrust cases that you discussed at the beginning of volume two, where economists generally are like really against cartels, and Taft is, you know, not. And so it struck me that rather than think of it as
the which cases?
The antitrust cases. Like they're general, right. There's a kind of classic question in, or kind of way economists differentiate themselves from conservatives, which is to say that like, we're in favor of markets, not businessmen. And businessmen say we're in favor of businessmen and markets can go, you know, whatever, as long as we make a profit. And Taft, as you construct him, seems to me to be a very recognizable modern figure of a pro-businessman's interests, at least in the economic sphere, which is not like a radically pro-markets, pro-prosperity, but rather a pro-stability, pro-business, traditional American business elite figure. So is that right or not? Is it that he's a pro-markets guy, sometimes he says some things like that? Or is he just like, what's good for GM is good for the country type figure?
Well, I don't think he would have separated those two things. I mean, to begin with, he would have seen them as the same thing. His economics wasn't developed enough to make the sharp distinction that you're making. So that's the first point. The second point is, it's really interesting that in Euclid, so everyone understands that Euclid is the case in which the court upheld zoning. Very controversial case. And surprising, because Sutherland writes the opinion for the court. But what you have to understand is that Taft and Sutherland voted the other way. We have the, you know, one of the things I found in this book is I was rummaging around in the attic of the Supreme Court. I found a locked trunk and they had lost the keys. We had to call a locksmith and we opened it up. And then there were these locked books inside it and we had to call the locksmith back. And they were Butler's and Stone's docket books for the 1920s. I don't know how they ended up in the Supreme Court building because they weren't even, that building hadn't been built when these books were written. And most of these docket books were burned at the end of the term. But I've been able in this book to compare the voting at conference with the ultimate opinion. So Taft, at the first time Euclid came up for a vote, Taft voted the other way, as did Sutherland. So it would have gone against zoning. And something turned them around. We don't really know what, but the best bet is it was a brief by a city planner. And this brief talked about the fact that uncontrolled markets in urban property are extremely inefficient. They destroy the value of property in ways that are that create terrible externalities. And so what you really need to do is you really have to have a different concept of property for urban areas, which is what the New York Zoning Commission had said in the first Great Zoning Act of 1917. And it's possible that that turned them around. In the book, I offer three different hypotheses. It's really impossible to know which one is true, but they're all in there in some ways. One is that this notion property creates incentives, and you want to have the independent property owner whose character is developed through property, but urban property didn't function like that, because it was too interdependent. And so it was like a traffic light rather than like a truncation of liberty that mattered to incentives. So that's one possibility. And there's a lot of language one could talk about in there and a lot of people who were writing that to them. A second is that by allowing zoning, you kept out undesirables like blacks or aliens or lower class Jews on the Lower East Side. And there's a lot of language in Sutherland's opinion which picks up this theme. There are many different ways in which one could think about this case. And I don't think any single way one can know.
Yeah. So one other thing that shows up in Euclid that really becomes a big theme in the second volume is the court's relation to local and state government. So in Euclid, they embrace local authority even against the needs of the metropolitan area. So the village of Euclid holds out and says, we're not going to have manufacturing here, even though the city of the broader metropolitan region of Cleveland may need it. But in other, and the court embraces that embrace of localism. But in other places, the court really is quite insensitive to, and you describe it as a very nationalistic court. And so I wonder if you could just get us started in talking about the role Prohibition played. So Prohibition is obviously the first volume is mostly about the court responding to World War I. The second volume is largely about the court responding to the challenges of Prohibition and the court kind of dealing with both the rule of law aspects of that and also the federalism aspect. So maybe you get us started talking about why was Prohibition so hard for the Taft Court?
Well, let's go back to the narrative of custom and tradition. So custom and tradition, if you're a common law lawyer, prohibition is the worst kind of statute. It's a sumptuary law that violates the traditions and customs of half the population of the United States, right? Prohibition, it was a form of regulation that was systematically and overtly defied in every major city in the United States. It was defied by ethnic communities who, you know, said, what do you mean I can't have my beer? What are you talking about? And part of that isn't prohibition itself. It isn't the constitutional amendment. It was the Volstead Act, which was the product of the Anti-Saloon League, which was the product of rural evangelical churches, which read the 18th Amendment to be bone dry, no liquor at all, no beer, no nothing. And this Protestant interpretation of it was flagrant. Remember in Babbitt, Sinclair Lewis's novel, and he says, he has a cocktail party and he says, anyone ready to break the law? You know, and so for the prohibition breaks the conservatives on the court into two factions. There's Sutherland and Butler and McReynolds, who believe that ultimately the law of prohibition could be legitimated only by being brought at to the extent that the court could in line with custom and tradition. So they were very hostile to prohibition. I can show statistically that the court was much more divided over prohibition, and the alignments were quite different than in any other case. And they so they were hostile to attempts to override the customs of the people. On the other hand, there were three conservatives, Taft and Sanford and Vannevar, who believed that you couldn't have open defiance of the law by elites, that that would undercut the rule of law itself. And so they actually adopt language and decision-making, which is indistinguishable from Holmesian positivism in the prohibition context. And, you know, because they ally with Brandeis and with Holmes on this, they have a court 5-4 on these important decisions. And these decisions really paved the way for the New Deal and the nationalism of the New Deal and the positivism of the New Deal. That was the majority of this coalition of conservative positivism, which you do not see again until William Rehnquist. That's the first conservative positivist I can think of after the prohibition is repealed in the 30s. But it forces these three justices into that position. It puts Brandeis in a really interesting position because Brandeis wants to defer to prohibition because it's a democratic enactment. And yet he sees that this is so contrary to what people believe is right. It's so mala prohibita in a world in which mala in se should matter, that it's undermining the administrative state itself. And so that leads him to sort of begin to theorize on the left that it's not enough to have simple majoritarianism by the administrative state if the administrative state is understood to act in ways that override what people consider to be the legitimate limits on government. And so he begins to develop in his Olmsted dissent, where he talks about wiretapping as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. That whole argument depends upon notions of privacy, which are common law notions of privacy, common law customary notions of where your dignity is, and using that to limit the positive state, which is something that you would have put with McReynolds and Sutherland and whatever. He puts it to different uses. He has a different sense of what these customs are. But that, again, doesn't emerge until, say, a case like Griswold versus Connecticut, in which you see in Harlan's opinion and in Goldberg's opinion, the same left-wing communitarian view that the state can't act in ways. So prohibition force is like a forced development of jurisprudential trends which aren't going to happen for another 50 years. So that's really interesting. A second thing that's really interesting about prohibition is that it's national. And it's viewed as national overreaching. All of the wartime innovation, no, I shouldn't say that. Many of the wartime innovations are repealed because people have a revulsion against the federal government by 1919, except prohibition's in the Constitution, so it's entrenched. So it's the one, you know, major wartime innovation that you can't get rid of because it's constitutionalized. And, you know, the revulsion that people are feeling against the federal government is one reason the Child Labor Amendment fails in the 20s, because they're reacting against them. And so the court is issuing these extremely nationalist opinions in the context of prohibition, and also in the context of some regulation like the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, is changed in 1920 in the most radical possible way. It's made the manager of all the railroads, intra as well as interstate. This is inconceivable before World War I, inconceivable for two reasons. One is we didn't have the statistical and economic ability to do that kind of regulation at the national government, but we did after World War I, which brought economists and statisticians into the government and created this form of knowledge, econometric knowledge, statistical knowledge, which would be necessary to do national regulation at the scale of the ICC. And it was inconceivable because it was the nation which was doing it, which, you know, even though they didn't nationalize the railroads, they effectively put it under the national control of the ICC. And so, and the Taft Court participated in that fully. On the other hand, when they tried to nationalize child labor and child labor tax, no, we need state local control. So the basic point about the 1920s is it's confused. I mean, you're getting both of these trends, and the Taft Court is going in both of these directions. It does not have a coherent account of federal state relations. It's going every which way, because every which way is present in the 20s. That's what made it so hard to get a kind of overall narrative out of this.
Wait, I have one question to follow up here. When the confusion of the 20s, and particularly as it relates to federalism, but also broadly speaking, the story, is you have this social confusion, but you have political stability threat, which is, it is a situation in which you have the same party winning all the elections along, they vary in their takes, particularly from Hoover, from Coolidge to Hoover. But you have this social disagreement without political disagreement, and you have very strong stability in which states are voting for which party too. So how do you think about that problem, which is you have this like roiling social conflict in the face of which is very different from the modern period? So one of the things all history is contemporary history, but the recent period, you know, who wins elections changes really radically, you know, and so you have a very different type of story.
Well, see, you're associating political difference with political party. And that was actually not so much the case in the 20s. I mean, the Democratic Party is the Southern Democratic Party. So the fact that Woodrow Wilson allied it with labor was appalling to most of the Democrats from the South. So, the Democratic Party kind of shattered. It didn't know what it was after Wilson. Wilson was this major force for disruption in it, especially after World War I. So Democratic Party is like all over the map. You get progressives in it who are, you know, who later join in opposing the New Deal. You get and who are very, you know, people like McAdoo and like that, who are KKK, Southern KKK, but progressives. I mean, the Democratic Party is looking for its soul, and it kind of finds it over Prohibition in 1928 with Smith, but it doesn't, you know, at the beginning anyway. But the big differences are within the Republican Party. So when Harding is elected president, he appoints to his cabinet Hoover, on the one hand, who is the quintessential progressive bureaucrat. You know, Brandeis and others want him to run as a Democrat. He runs as a Republican. I mean, he's a Republican. And he appoints Mellon, who is the archetypical businessman conservative. And Henry Cabot Lodge says, I don't want Hoover. And Harding says, it's Hoover and Mellon. I really want Mellon, but not Hoover. And Harding knows that he's putting the two halves of the Republican Party together. So you get Hoover and Mellon, or you don't get Mellon. So he knows what he's doing when he brings these together. And they have very different attitudes toward antitrust. Hoover's attitude toward antitrust is, we want to have business associations. We want to have efficient markets, which means sharing information, et cetera. The other part of the Republican Party, like Taft, is against that. You know, he's for the old style antitrust where you can't share information. So the Republican Party is reflecting these different kinds of policies. What's interesting about the court, and is almost invisible from modern eyes, is that you have to look at those. There are many occasions in which the court is imagining itself not in a positivist way. So we are all positivists. We're all the heirs of Holmes. So when we ask the Supreme Court, are you speaking now for federal law? Are you speaking for state law? What's the authority? This is what we do all the time. In the Taft Court era, the court in many, many, many kinds of cases understood itself as a common law court. This is the conflation of common law liberties with the 14th Amendment. And many times when it read the Constitution, it understood itself not to be speaking for federal law or state law, but for the law of the whole American people, the way a common law court would. And you can see that in many of these opinions. It's absolutely fascinating. And of course, the best example of it is federal general common law, in which they did exactly that. And that's why Holmes hated general common law so much. So the court in its own mind occupied a position that was neither federal nor state. And we can't recreate that form of authority now. It takes a real leap of historical imagination for us to imagine a court that could speak like that. But, you know, that's Myers, to go back to Sam's question earlier.
So, I mean, this could go in so many directions. But on that specific point, I wanted some clarification, because one thing that comes out really, you know, clearly and interestingly is that we have to abandon our kind of vulgar positivism and realism, even to understand this era. And that's true with respect to the so-called general law, you know, which conservatives today are struggling to exhume and make credible, not very successfully. But then there's another thread in your book, maybe in different places, about how everyone was already a realist and an instrumentalist with respect to law. And I just am not fully grasping how these two claims come together. So, I mean, one place where this comes out is this amazing chapter 20, which is about how, this is very Postian because it's about how the court can credibly claim legitimacy to declare what the law is, even though everyone knows by this point that they're making it up and they're in dialogue with the people, blah, blah, blah. But I guess I don't understand how, if everyone, including the conservatives, you know, is on board with this, let's call it instrumentalist realist picture, how they can also be pre-modern in their understanding of the common law and the general law and so forth.
Well, they're not positivists.
Right, I understand that.
But they're not formalists. So what you were asking is formalism. Okay. And so I just listened to a lecture by Scott Shapiro, so I learned what formalism is. you know, complete, there's an answer to everything, it's determinate, and you don't need to look at consequences. No one was a formalist like that in that I could see at the time.
Okay.
No one believed any of that. So I think formalism is this construction, because we need to know who realists were attacking. We need different ways of understanding what their contribution was, not formalism. At least in Portard's justices I know anything about, none of them were formalists in that sense. So they are not formalists. They're all consequentialists. And the narratives I'm giving you, the four narratives, these are the forms of consequentialism that they had. So that's compatible with it being indeterminate, right? None of them, all of them knew that they were making the law to serve ends, and that, you know, it wasn't like a mechanical thing. And in point of fact, there's this wonderful letter that Taft writes Southern when he's appointed. And he says, a guy who needs political experience, because interpreting the Constitution is a political matter. They understand that perfectly well.
So they're post-formalists, but there's still a dispute about, you know, whether the kind of legislature, either the American people, when they frame the Constitution in a kind of like what the way originalists would think about it, or, you know, Congress when it comes to statutes is the source, or whether there's just out in the ether some like much broader set of norms which to be consequentialist about. Okay. Let me turn to kind of, please.
So when you say originalism arises after Erie destroys the status of the court as a common law court. So I'm a common law court. I'm speaking for the American ethos. Suddenly I can't speak for the American ethos. I have to speak for that document, which is under glass. Well, what the hell is that document? Right. And that is the framework that allows a philosophy like originalism to arise. It would have been inconceivable to be an originalist in the 1920s.
Understood. I mean, supposing Holmes had been a little different, maybe he could take a step closer to it insofar as originalism has a bit of positivism about it, thinking that, you know, the American people laid down this law. So
but there are many positivisms, you know,
right?
Positivism under what sign? So for Holmes, it's your positive meaning you want to give it to the legislature because you have a Darwinian understanding of what society is.
Absolutely.
Originalists have a Hobbesian understanding.
All right, so let me come to, you know, maybe where I'm a little resistant to your framing. And it really goes to your desire to identify with a kind of hero in this story. You mentioned him earlier, Brandeis, and vilify Holmes. And it's very interesting how that comes out, because you know, you note how proximate they were, especially relative to the others. And, you know, you turn up evidence in, you know, about the conference that they disagreed more there. And then Holmes is kind of grateful to have a public occasion to be seen as doing something different. You know, when Brandeis is appointed, he says, "I'm with Holmes." On the other hand, you routinely use the word radical to say just how different Brandeis's assumptions were, because Holmes was, you know, this basically social Darwinist who just wanted to honor the dominant faction in society that had achieved, at least if it had achieved, majority, whereas Brandeis is laying out, you know, what you think of as liberalism. So I want to ask just, I don't know, a couple of questions. I mean, I saw you, you know, resist the idea that you're against Holmes in your, let's say, idolatry of Brandeis. But what's kind of surprised me a little bit in the Brandeis chapter is that when you lay this out, it's clear that Brandeis is a kind of perfectionist liberal. Like, he thinks that the goal of society should be to promote the flourishing of the individual, and then social policy, including economic policy, is about what's the best way of arranging that. Where I guess I didn't see a lot of evidence in that particular chapter is any commitment to democracy. Now, of course, he is deferential when, for example, some minority wants to say, no, the Constitution forbids, you know, social legislation. But I guess Holmes seems like the Democrat here, and he's committed to at least, you know, enough democracy that it's not, you know, only about the kind of dominant faction in society. It's that, like, every person counts for one in voting and no one for more than one. Whereas Brandeis seems just to have a liberal political philosophy that I guess I wasn't fully seeing its relation to self-government, self-rule. And so I want to hear more about why you want to see him as the Democrat, not Holmes.
Well, I mean, to answer that question, I think goes to a deep issue that, you know, you and I have discussed many times, which is, what do you mean by democracy in that question?
Of course.
You know, many legal theorists identify democracy with majoritarianism. That is to say, it's whatever the people vote. And that's correct. What democracy is. To me, that is a decision-making mechanism. So you could have majority vote in North Korea, and it's not going to be democracy.
For
it's not
sure.
going to be democracy because you don't have the freedom of speech that allows public opinion to form. But, you know, there are many reasons why. So you cannot confuse one person, one vote with democracy. Holmes did not care about democracy. He doesn't use the word democracy. It's he thought of the democratic citizen as thick-fingered clowns. That's the word he used to describe them. And he thinks that legislatures are important because they allow for orderly change in the midst of existential conflict in society. So for him, that's the function of legislatures. They allow order, stress on orderly, meaning it's not war, because he knew war, and he didn't want the country to descend into war. And he thought of law as an alternative to war, a little Hobbesian that way. Brandeis, in the chapter in which you're citing, is always starting from the premise of democracy. And the premise for democracy for him is self-government. It's a moral premise. And I accept that. I think that's right. Democracy is governing its self-government as opposed to its autonomy, as opposed to heteronomy. And then the question is how we, first person plural, govern ourselves. Versus I, when, you know, I'm going to lose an election, how am I governing myself with, like, you know, all of those questions. And those require, the way Hans Kelsen theorized it, the way many people have theorized it, Claude Lefort would be another one, is you identify with the processes of decision making because they respect you. So it's a moral impulse, that's to say self-government, and like Kantian ultimate enlightenment, not a matter just of decision making, not majoritarianism, but all of the things necessary for you to have this sense of democratic legitimation. And Brandeis is theorizing those right and left in that chapter. He says, you know, what has to be true for people to be, he said, the sovereigns. I mean, he just theorizes it from the ground up, and he theorizes it not as an individual issue, but there are strong individual things in Brandeis, but he theorizes that as a we, not as an I. And, you know, and in the great dissent in Truax, he says, among other things, when we make a decision in our legislature, identification, we have to make judgments because we're trading off that. I mean, he gives a whole account of what that might look like and what the constitutional implications of that are. He's deriving it from this value of self-governance. Holmes never does any of that. He doesn't care about any of that.
So I have a lot of questions about this, and I want to click two real quick ones, because in general, I found Sam's story that you, like, Brandeis gets a bit of shine, but as you go through the story, Holmes seems like a better, like, you seem to be evolving in some ways to, like, a little more Holmesian respect. And let me tell you what I mean. So first, your story of Holmes is a little different from the story, that the version of it that I think it sounds a lot like in popular mind, which was the Luc Menand version of Holmes in the Metaphysical Club, in which in that story, Holmes is just haunted by the Civil War, and you do that. But your story of Holmes has him in the Civil War, but also suggests he's like a really nice fit for the 1920s, because it's all 1920s is all about social conflict. And he says, oh my God, I can't decide these questions. Society needs to decide them. There's no we to be found here. And it's not about the Civil War. It's not only about the Civil War, or it's not about the ghosts of the Civil War. I go, they're there. And you pay heed to that, and the bullet found in his neck and all of that business. But rather that looking at the 1920s, communitarianism seems a little ridiculous because everyone hates each other so much. So what is the community that we are bearing? So is Holmes actually the right figure for the 1920s in your view? Is my version of the Robert Post is still evolved through the story, which is a Brandeisian, but then kind of gets a more respect for Holmes as the story goes on, accurate or inaccurate?
I never had disrespect for Holmes. I mean, to me, I've read every Holmes opinion in the 20s, and he is like the kid who takes the exam, who gets the question exactly right every time, who understand, you know, gets the A+ on the, he is so bright, and he is, he likes, I want to know where the fingers pinch, you know, where the machine pinches, and he gets it every single goddamn time. It's the most amazing thing. The man it was so bright and so disciplined about what he did. And so you can't come away with anything but admiration for him. The interesting thing, of course, is that, you know, we all talk about him as the legal realist and the life of the law is experience, not logic. As a judge, Holmes is all about logic. He doesn't care about experience at all. He has a jurisprudence, and everything follows from the jurisprudence. Everything follows from the jurisprudence. So he is like a logical machine. Just bam. It's just astonishing to read him. And you can't come away with anything but respect for how he does it. You know, whether you agree with him or not, he's got the essential issue and he's talking about it.
Yeah. So, but I wanted to then, like, maybe follow up on the second part of that question, which maybe not as artfully asked as I would have liked, which is the version of the 1920s that you're telling. This is very much a history of the 1920s as much as it's a history of the Supreme Court, is one in which, like, a story about our commonness, whether it's the conservative version of it in the custom version or the Brandeisian version of it, of like a true theory of democracy, just seems a little hollow against this social conflict, which is, this is a question about now, not a question about then, really, which is that in eras of extraordinary conflict, theories of like emergent theories of the good seem really difficult to maintain because we really don't agree about what's good. And that's I literally cover. And so we're our from the story, our Taft, I mean, my read of it, you know, that Taft and Hobbes are the modern figures in some ways, in which the we'll get into the I want to get into the very end about the return of the common law, which Sam previewed, but the general common law. But whereas Brandeis and custom seem like the kind of conservatives seemed like the kind of were big figure were modern figures, but not right now. So fit in terms of fit to time, is that story consistent with what you think or just inconsistent with what you think?
That's a question above my pay grade. So I mean, that's the first thing I want to say about it. You know, I'm not, I don't know enough about the present. I mean, Holmes is a very...
You're on a podcast. You can say whatever you want. You're an hour into a podcast. At this point, people who are listening just want post takes. They want hot takes like you're a guest on MSNBC. Come on, man.
So, I mean, one of the reasons Holmes is so popular in the 20s, it's like this is the time of Henry Ford reconstructed villages. The 20s is a time of the most intense nostalgia for everything they were in the process of losing, right? And Holmes is the most nostalgic figure possible. I mean, Holmes is the only living person probably in 1927 who can remember talking to John Quincy Adams. You know, Holmes is, he remembers his mother talking about being evacuated from Boston in the Revolutionary War. And he fought in the Civil War and he exemplifies a past that he, let's just put it this way, has no respect for, but he exemplifies it as a public figure.
And an amazing mustache.
And an amazing mustache. So this is Holmes. And, you know, his popular figureness is one thing. I mean, he's very popular in the left because, of course, he allows for all the legislative reconstruction. And Frankfurter is a publicity machine for him that is par none. You know, it's like he is just like, I want him for my agent, Frankfurter, in the 1920s. So that's Holmes, who is the staggeringly popular figure. So he captures one half of the 20s. For example, he captures prohibition perfectly. He's the perfect justice for prohibition. But prohibition is intensely unpopular, you know. So it's a very complicated story. Now, for us, this is my sense, you know, I teach First Amendment. That's my subject matter, you know. And you might have noticed there's very little about the First Amendment in this book, almost nothing. Because I didn't want to write about stuff that I already knew. So if you ask now, I mean, the First Amendment is always about the construction of a we. And the court now has turned the First Amendment into a liberty that's individual, that's precisely not Brandeisian and not Holmesian. It's not anything. It's libertarian. And so when I say I like Brandeis, I think it gives me great resources to hold the court's feet to the fire in their misinterpretations of the First Amendment, for example. And I also think that no democracy can survive unless it has a we. Otherwise, it's just a counting mechanism, and it can fall to pieces, as we're in the process of doing. So to me, those lessons don't disappear. They become more salient.
So I want to bring a couple of things we've talked about together and then pivot to a final segment on kind of court power, which is a topic at the heart of this book. So first, you know, to go back to our earlier exchange, you know, I thought it was really revealing in the discussion of Meyer that you say that there's a way in which, in spite of his general Holmesianism, Brandeis agreed a lot with McReynolds. It's just they had, let's call it, a petty dispute about when judges should preempt majority rule in the name of the preconditions of republicanism, what you call democracy. And when the conservative said property was at the absolute center, Brandeis didn't join them. But when they said, you know, kind of in response to popular rage and Meyer, that, you know, education is part of the making of democratic citizenship, then Brandeis was was with them. And, you know, Holmes seemed to have a view of democracy that says, well, when there's a dispute about what, you know, should be protected, the question is who decides? And again, majority rule is not a mere decision procedure because it's based on the very simple idea that every person counts equally. And when there's a dispute, you just ask everyone. So, you know, as a transition to a discussion of kind of court power in the 20s, could you reflect a little bit on that? Because I would prefer to see, you know, Brandeis v. Holmes as a dispute among liberals about whether who you empower to resolve what the core values of democracy are.
Yeah. Well, it'd be very hard to class Holmes as a liberal in a modern sense of liberal. And also, he could care less about the moral force of majoritarianism, the way in which you put it in your argument. That's not Holmes.
Okay.
Holmes is Darwinian. You could make the argument you're making. It's just don't put it in Holmes's mouth.
I think Thayer did, but never mind.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't want to talk, but on the court, as a jurisprudence, Holmes is not talking that language. And Brandeis is talking that language. And you might think of the modern descendant of Brandeis as John Hart Ely. You know, what are the rights necessary for the kind of moral sense of majoritarianism? And, Ely gives arguments about freedom of speech, but not about, you know, abortion. You know, he has a whole take on what would be and not be necessary. And that would be disputable within that line, but that's the line that Brandeis takes. So before Ely, this is the way in which he's thinking about the problem. What is necessary? And I cite these notes that Frankfurter jots of a conversation with him exactly about what is necessary in order for us to form a we in a democratic state. And he says, with respect to those, you need clear and present danger before the state can regulate them. It's a really interesting line, and it tells you exactly what he's thinking in Meyer. And that's true in other cases in which he, for example, joins the court in striking down the Kansas Court of Industrial Relations, which had compelled arbitration and price setting for companies because he imagined it in the same way. I mean, these are cases that are happening at exactly the same time. So that's how I would understand the difference between the two.
Great. I mean, in passing, I'm not sure about the Ely connection because, you know, in part because of how he's been remembered, you know, it's easy to forget that he was such an intense critic of court intervention in the name of substantive values. And one would have to make a case that, you know, the kinds of things protected in Meyer and Pierce kind of out of the ether would be central to either the protection of minorities, which is plausible, but we haven't talked about, or part of representation reinforcement. But, you know, given limited time, let's talk about court power because, you know, that is your narrative. That's what's going on in the Supreme Court in the 20s. And I guess I wanted to just let listeners hear you talk about the judge's bill and, you know, the pivotal role of the Chief Justice in transforming our Supreme Court from a kind of appeals court of last resort into what we would think of in international terms as a constitutional court, basically, you know, linked to a case and controversy requirement, but opining for the future about the meaning of the Constitution.
Another way in which it's really almost impossible for a modern, unless you really make an effort to recover what the Supreme Court was in the 1920s, is the fact that about 84% of its opinions were unanimous. You know, why was that? And, you know, now unanimity is like 20%, 20%. What accounts for that gigantic difference? There's a number of theories. One is that they had less controversial cases because they didn't, you know, they had a lot of appeals, which were required mandatory jurisdiction. So they had a lot of trivial cases. Another is it was before legal realism. There's all of these, you know, things floating around. So by looking at the docket books, I was able to show that in point of fact, if you look at their conferences and you look at it for the certiorari cases, the cases which were discretionary and so presumably more controversial, their unanimity rate was down in the 30s. You know, but they acquiesced. They came together to have a unanimity rate, which was extremely high. So they gave up their differences, and they thought it was part of their judicial responsibility to do that. I call that a norm of acquiescence. And why is that? It's because until 1925, the Supreme Court was just basically a final appellate tribunal. It was like the final appeal. You appeal to the Court of Appeals and you appeal to the Supreme Court. And so it had, and so it functioned just like a Court of Appeals. You had to decide it. And the finality was the most important thing of the case before it. So most of the cases were trivial, and the court's authority came from having to decide a particular case and get it done in the end. So given that huge docket, one of the enormous revolutions that Taft makes, he makes many, but one of the most important one is the Judiciary Act of 1925, in which he converts the court from a final appellate tribunal into what contemporaries called a ministry of justice, which is to say, I get to choose my own docket. And that means to say, I get to have an agenda about how federal law is going to develop. And so I'm basically doing policy. I'm no longer just deciding cases. I'm intervening strategically into the development of federal law. And that means when they're writing opinions, they're no longer writing them to the litigants the way that the court did. And that undergirded the unanimity rate, which was characteristic of a court that did that. Instead, they're writing to the general public to develop general law. And so once you start doing that, then the whole basis for this unanimity disintegrates, because everyone can talk to the general public. You don't need a court to do that. And it means that the development of their policy proposals have the legitimacy of any other policymaking body, not of a court of final tribunal, a court of final appeal. And that leads to the situation that Bickel, I think, very well theorized when he said the legitimacy of any Supreme Court decision is that it begins a conversation with the American people. It's not law until it's accepted by the American people. And that conversation can go on and on, you know, on and on and on. The members of the Taft Court would have found that appalling. They didn't understand the nature of a judicial authority in that way. It's a great anecdote in the late 30s when a Brandeis clerk was asked, would Brandeis approve giving briefings to the public about, you know, the implications and the policy implications of the opinion? He said, no, of course not. That's not our job. Our job is to just decide the case. And so it's that which leads to the crisis of judicial authority. We don't have to separate politics and law anymore. Because of that change that he introduced into the procedure of the court and converted the nature of the authority of the institution, it's silent. But it's so deep.
So one more for me. I mean, I just want to say before asking it how much I loved that thread. I already mentioned the chapter on the authority of the court and how kind of that connects to this other passage in the Judges Bill chapter where you say this power grab, if you will, totally changed the legitimation problem. But I just was curious then where kind of popular criticism of the court fits into your narrative. I mean, it would be absurd to say this is a court-centric book because it's literally a history of the court. That was the job. And your research is very honorably in the judges' papers and et cetera. And we learn so much about these individuals. But then I guess I wanted to hear more about how 1923, as far as I can tell, I mean, we've talked about the Muted Fury book was like the very height of popular discontent with the Supreme Court in U.S. history with all the reform proposals. And that was before the Judges Bill. And then the Judges Bill chapter is more about kind of the judges trying to remember, like, who had written the bill and when it started. And I just wasn't, I was shocked that there was this big power grab 2 years after 1923. And there doesn't seem to have been like kind of, it just was accepted and no one noticed almost. And yet, you know, you're unearthing this history. Steve Vladeck does a lot with the Taft Court's hijinks in his story of the, you know, deep origins of the shadow docket and so forth. So could you reflect a bit on, you know, on kind of the dialogue with the people in a way, you know, it also needs to be about kind of criticisms of the court as an institution when it engages in this kind of power grab.
Yeah, I put that story in the part of the book that deals with socioeconomic legislation, actually at the end of the Adkins chapter. What happens is Adkins and a number of labor decisions arouse intense opposition to the court. So labor is calling for the end of judicial review. Many senators are calling for legislation that you need a 7-2, things like that. And, you know, just the court is at the center of enormous controversy at the beginning of the decade. And it culminates in 1924, when Robert La Follette runs for president. It's a third party run. And on his platform is the end of judicial review, that, you know, we will no longer accept Congress can override the court when it makes a constitutional decision. And La Follette is killed by Coolidge. And in the Adkins, I have correspondence between Taft and Vandervander, where they say the defeat of La Follette has cured the public of this opposition to the court. And I don't think we're going to see any more of these bills in the Senate, so that, you know, now we're going to have a free hand for the rest of the decade. And they do, in point of fact, that's right. When they start to overreach. After the election, which is October 24, and the judge's bill is in the next, you know, 25. And after that, it just, the energy just dissipates. And it doesn't begin to accumulate again until 1927 and the Bedford Stone decision, which prevents unions from organizing and boycotting goods. And that just pisses off the AFL big time, and the opposition to the court picks up again. So, you know, we think of the end of liberalism in the 20s. It's just not true. I mean, right through 1924, it was gigantic. And then 1927 starts to pick up again.
Right.
One of the amazing threads in the book about, like, Taft is the master politician of the court, or master administrator slash, and it's almost one of the things that's hardest to get your head around is the idea of two Supreme Court justices writing legislation for Congress that was, and then not just on their own operations, but also on all of civil procedure, you know, like getting the, you know, and the thing that was, I was wondering about this, is that you tell a really, really compelling story about their recreation of the court in their own image, both Taft and Vandervander. But it was a little unclear what other options were out there, because we've since seen, as Sam noted, like, lots of innovations on the form of the court. But I was a little unclear about what, other than the status quo, were other things out there that if the court had institutionalized, which, as you note, like, that's the most modern, like, the court in the late 20s looks a lot like the modern Supreme Court, at least in its procedures, and then soon after looks like the court after Erie, which is, you know, not, you know, what would a different institutional form have looked like? Did they consider anything? Was there anything out there that would have, yeah, so What might the Supreme Court have looked like if not for Taft being the Supreme politician?
I mean, you know, when they started falling behind in their docket in 22, the ABA comes out with a proposal to increase the number of justices. The ABA is pushing that, and Holmes says that would be terrible. Taft writes his brother, who is the head of the jurisprudence section of the ABA, saying, "Shut up, Henry. you know, Cadwallader, which is Taft, that's Henry Taft. And he says, Henry, get the hell off of that project. You know, we don't want that. No one wants that. And he manages to squelch that. But that was the official, you know, and Beck, who was the attorney general, who was the solicitor general at the time, falls in line behind Taft. But personally, he really likes the idea of increasing the size of the court. And you can see that correspondence back and forward. So, I mean, there are other proposals on the table. But Taft is just such an overpowering force. He just basically plows through it. It's like amazing. It's amazing to watch his correspondence. I mean, he writes advisory opinions in secret and circulates them to the president and to the Speaker of the House to kill legislation he doesn't like. It's the most amazing thing what he's doing. I mean, he's acting like a branch of government that is legislative, just totally.
So with that, I think we're going to close. But I want to say just quickly that we started off with this as a monumental history and ended up talking about all of its modern resonances. And I really do think the book is, for all of Robert putting this aside, is like a deep meditation on the Supreme Court and on law in eras of disagreement like our own. So I couldn't recommend it any more highly to all of our listeners. And I just want to say thank you, Robert. This was awesome.
Thank you. I can't tell you, it's such a pleasure to have a conversation with people who've actually read it. It's like amazing.
We partly read it unlike some other podcasters and New Yorker writers.
Hey, speak for yourself. I made it through all the footnotes.
Okay, I have not read
fair,
it. Through.
But to be fair, the footnotes are extraordinary. Where you do delve into them, as I did in the Euclid chapter, it's like a whole other book is going on.
I wanted it to be like the Mishnah, the Talmud. I wanted it to have a little bit of text, which was the text, and then surround it by commentary and comment because it's so much. But they wouldn't let me do that.
There are chapters that are like that, though. So chapter where
even Cambridge University Press has, you know, become, you know, crowd pleasing.
It has.
Well, thank you so much, and
thank you, Robert.
Thank you both.